Now, back to Stand Up with Pete Dominic on Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, welcome back to the conversation. He is here, our savior, the man who has all the answers, or many of the answers. He's an expert on health care and health insurance. He's also a pediatrician. He's an author. He's written books debunking myths, and I go through his intro every week, and I should underscore how great those books are about debunking medical myths. They're a great idea for a gift for the holiday season, which is quickly approaching. It'll be here before you know it. Don't swallow your gum and don't cross your eyes are the titles of these two books. You should get them. There's a third one coming out very soon. Most importantly, you should follow him on Twitter. And if you aren't yet, you will after you hear him talk, if you are indeed on Twitter. We've even had people create accounts just so they could follow Dr. Aaron Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's. And I made a huge scheduling mistake, and he can only join us for half an hour this morning. That's my fault. But thank you for being here. Can we start with the illegal immigrant issue quickly? Because we just had a dust up on the phones about that.
Sure. But what is the exact issue?
The
fact that it's a whole big problem and everything. What was the exact problem? I wasn't listening. I apologize.
Yeah, you're probably listening to ONA, and I respect that.
No, I was getting the kids off to school.
Okay, very good. The issue is that illegal immigrants cannot buy into Obamacare. They can't buy they are not allowed to buy private insurance.
Well, they're not allowed to buy private insurance through the exchanges.
Through the newly established exchanges.
They can forget the subsidy. They cannot even offer to pay full price to buy an insurance policy.
Let's start there.
Okay.
Why would you make a? Is there an economic argument? Is there any kind of fiscal conservative argument preventing illegal immigrants from buying anything, much less private insurance on these exchanges?
I suppose. If you had solid evidence that as a population the undocumented immigrant population was significantly more unhealthy, then allowing them into the risk pool would raise the price of premiums for everybody. However, the undocumented population I think tends to be rather young. In fact, lots of kids who tend to be rather cheap. So likely there's no good evidence to say that would be the case.
But if everybody that bought into it were sick, that would be a bad thing. But
yeah, because in other words, if they were all horrifically ill and you let them all buy in, then it would raise the price of premiums for everybody. But that I don't believe that's no one made that argument as far as I know, do I think there's any evidence that is the case. It was much more the idea that I think people, conflated the idea of giving subsidies and letting people buy insurance all into one big benefit, as if, being able to pay full price for insurance is a benefit and they didn't want anyone to get the benefit.
What about though the subsidies? You can understand why someone wouldn't want an undocumented immigrant to get taxpayer money to subsidize their health care, right?
If they're not paying tax, I mean, yes, I believe I could understand an argument that if somebody wasn't paying taxes and then taking money out of the system, that would seem to be unfair. I suppose that I can understand that argument, even though, again, when people show up in the emergency room, we're still going to wind up paying for their care anyway. So it's,
How do we wind up paying for their care at the emergency room? It's clear that they're not paying their bills, not only illegal undocumented immigrants, but many Americans that get care in the emergency room don't end up paying that bill. How does that end up costing me something?
Well, before sort of the Affordable Care Act and actually into the near future, hospitals would provide care to the uninsured, and they would often suck up the cost. Either that would mean that they would have to raise the cost for everyone else, in other words, cost shifting for everybody else, in other words, to pay for it. Sometimes they would get extra money from the government in the form of Medicaid payments and disproportionate hospital share payments. That, of course, is all tax money, which means that it has to come out of somewhere, which is Americans' pockets. And sometimes it would just be in sort of direct payments that state governments would decide that they would cover, which, again, is local tax dollars. This all sort of comes out in the end, comes out in some way that everybody else pays more, whether through the private or the public sector. So, it's not as if we can deprive people of life-saving care in the emergency room. They're going to get that no matter what. That often winds up being very expensive.
One thing I'm confused about, healthcare.gov, this website that is such a disaster, is the difference between that website and states that run their own exchanges because of the Obamacare law. Is there a difference between states running their own exchanges and their own website and the healthcare.gov website?
Yeah. Well, the healthcare.gov website, eventually, you know, once you choose a state, winds up sending you to a, you know, a specific place. Now, granted, it's not a physical location. It's on the Internet. But the states that decided to do their own exchanges designed their own websites, hired their own contractors, got their own insurance companies involved, and so they did their own thing. The federal government, on the other hand, did everybody else, which is at least half the states or about half the states. So the federal government was responsible for, like, their website. The states that did their own exchanges were responsible for their websites. So they're not built by the same people necessarily, and they're not constructed in the same way.
And that's a different issue than the Medicaid expansion. The states that haven't accepted a Medicaid expansion and the states that run their own exchanges, those are different.
Completely different. There are states that are running their own exchanges that have not taken the Medicaid expansion. There are states that are doing the Medicaid expansion yet not running their own. One has absolutely nothing to do with the other. They're two completely independent.
One big issue has been that Republican-run states, legislatures, especially Republican governors in different states, about 25 of them, I think, have not entered the Medicaid expansion. They're not allowing that, although we are now seeing the state of Ohio, which is, of course, run by Republican John Kasich. They're now opting into the Medicaid expansion, and you predicted that all states eventually will opt in. Maybe you didn't, but what's going on here?
I think that history shows us that they will. I mean, again, look to original Medicaid. Medicaid was an optional program when it was first enacted back in the 60s, and mostly blue states jumped on board in the beginning, and a lot of red states held out. People have very short-term memories, but Arizona was the last state to join the Medicaid program. It was in the 80s. I mean, it was not that long ago that the final state decided to join and start doing Medicaid. And, you know, just a couple of decades later, Medicaid has become so bread and butter, apple pie American, that, you know, threatening to take it away is thought to be like having a gun to your head. As the Supreme Court decided, you can't tell states you're going to take away their Medicaid. It's so necessary and so American and so part of our natural culture that you can't take it away. And so it took a while. It took 20 years until the last state came on board. I don't doubt that we're going to have a similar run this time, where there'll be some states that hold out in the beginning, but as time goes on, it'll become a bigger problem. There'll be shifts in legislatures. More and more will buy into it, and eventually there'll be a few states standing alone, and it'll be, what's the point? You're not gaining that many political points anymore when you're one of the few that are left, and you're just saying no to a lot of federal dollars, which would help you provide insurance to your own citizens.
You wrote a piece for CNN published yesterday titled "Obamacare: A Disaster That Needs Fixing." I think you were referring to the website,
Everybody should know that the authors never write the titles; editors write the titles.
You must have been disappointed with that one.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm never really happy with the titles because I think that they're going for page views and clicks, not necessarily for what I'm writing. But I have no control over titles; never do. Nobody does. It's the website. The website's a disaster, not the whole, obviously, law, and I've received plenty of angry tweets and emails about that, and there's nothing I can do about it. But regardless, the website's a disaster. I mean, it's a disaster. It's not that they can't handle the volume. It's not that they were prepared. It turns out that the entire thing is broken from start to finish. Not only can people not get on and sort of register and get everything done cleanly, but the few applications that are trickling through and getting data to insurance companies are all garbage, and they can't even figure out what it's wrong. Like, the information being passed to the insurance companies is often not correct, and they're having to go through by hand and try to figure out, you know, was this person trying to sign up for a plan? Do they really qualify? What is it? All of this other stuff. They're not going to be able to do that, even if they fix the volume problems in the front end. These are millions of applications that have got to go through. The data's got to be clean. So there are problems through and through. And, of course, now that, you know, they're doing sort of exposés and everything else, you're finding out horrible stuff like, you know, days before it was supposed to go online, nobody had actually tested it from start to finish. And that, like, no one had really reported up the chain all the way to the top about how many problems there were or the fact that this wasn't ready to go. And that's a problem. It's a real problem. And, although this is not the entirety of the law, they wanted to get this going. There's a lot of, you know, will that has to happen. People are waiting for their insurance. There are lots of people that need it, and they cannot get it just because this won't work.
You can't build a really controversial new skyrise and then have the entrance not work.
No. Plus, this this also has, you know, it fuels the fire, not totally wrongly, you know, for people who believe the government can't do stuff efficiently. It's like, you know, this is an instance when, yeah, you know, the people that they put in charge were not technically savvy, did not probably understand, you know, the difficulties of having independent contractors, probably many of whom were the lowest bidder, put together software that has to talk to each other and be this big and this secure. And
But what I don't understand is, you know, and I wanted to ask you this, is the United States government, federal government, runs the Medicare website, the Social Security website, Department of Defense, VA, and so on. I mean, those websites seem similarly complex, and I don't hear, it doesn't mean there isn't, but a lot of complaints about them.
Well, the vast majority of people that sign up for Medicare do not do so, I think, over the Internet. I'd like to see statistics on that, but I think a lot of that is done through mail. It's automatic. You turn 65, you get something in the mail, you check a box, you get Medicare. No one has to check your requirements. Nobody has to check, you know, did you get it through your job? Do you qualify? What kind of subsidy are you going to get? It's the same exact thing for everybody. It's automatic. In the same way, you don't sign up for Medicaid on a website either. It just sort of happens. This is much, much more complicated in the sense that to get it going, they have to check how much money do you make, you know, how many people are in your family, do you get insurance, does that insurance qualify, will you get subsidies, how much will those subsidies be. We have to continually check and see if you have income changes during the year to see if your subsidies will change. It's a much more complicated process, and it also is signing up, you know, millions of people all at the same time in a new way. Also, it's 50 different programs. Remember, Medicare is federal. It's one program. Everybody gets exactly the same thing. There's one payer. It's government. This is 50 different state programs working with tons of different insurance companies, all of whom are buying different level plans. Medicare is Medicare is Medicare. It is so much simpler to do.
We're talking to Dr.
I'm sorry. This is a great argument for everybody who thought single payer was a better way to go. It's exactly the point. It's so much easier. It's so much simpler. It would have been done in 2 seconds.
Talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. You should read his piece about the disaster that is the healthcare.gov website. One more question, and then I go to our callers who have been calling in and wanting to talk to you, Dr. Carroll, which is, you understand and have written code. You've built websites. You know a lot about this, which is awesome because you're also a health policy expert. You really are a great go-to guy on all these issues. From everything that you have read and other IT experts have written and so on, what is your interpretation about the potential or possibility of when this will be up and running?
That's a great question. I don't think there's, I mean, you know, sort of reading the tea leaves and seeing everything else, I don't think there's any chance before well into November. You know, it sounds like this needs a massive overhaul. And that it, you know, originally everybody was sort of thinking and the government was sort of letting us believe it was just a volume issue. And that means just, you know, put more servers online, expand capacity, you'll be fine. But it turns out that was just the tip of the iceberg of the problems. And it's going to need, you know, massive fixes that I don't know that they can get done probably in time to start avoiding, individual mandate problems.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. They might have to delay the individual mandate.
Well, I think probably what they would wind up doing is delaying it in the states where they can't get everything going. You have to remember, a lot of states are working okay. You know that they're trickling through, they're getting stuff done. States that are working okay can keep the mandate going. States that are not could delay the mandate for a period of time until people you have just till later in the year to get insurance. They can push it back. It just makes this so much more complicated and problematic. And, you know, for those of us who, I think people sometimes assume that I'm a huge fan of the Affordable Care Act, that this is my, you know, this is the way I would have designed a healthcare system and that I just think it's awesome, or that I'm just such a, you know, pro-administration supporter that I love this. I swear, someday I hope you have archives and people can go back and listen to the tapes about how much I said this was going to be a problem, and that I think that this is better than nothing. But this is the problem of doing this sort of in this very complimentary, kludgy manner of providing, you know, 50 different exchanges of sort of trying to do this complex expansion of private insurance along with a Medicaid expansion. It is not as if we looked to the world and said, this is the best way to do it. It was like this was the politically feasible solution because back in the day, this was considered the conservative compromise. But it's a problem. It's a real problem, and a lot of the issues are being exposed.
Dr. Aaron Carroll joining us. Peter in Pennsylvania, go ahead.
In my opinion, I think people are missing some of the facts. I've been in the insurance business on a wholesale and retail level for 19 years.
Uh-huh.
All the website does is it qualifies you for a subsidy. You do not actually purchase the insurance through it.
Correct.
I can right now sell people a major insurance company product with a 1-1 effective date, a paper application, but it's unsubsidized.
Correct.
The unsubsidized rates are all higher than current rates on the market with medical underwriting. So, I mean, I'm a fan of...
That's the first place I'll take exception with you. It's like for some people it is higher, for other people it is not.
The majority, I would say the...
Well, I would disagree with that as well. I think that, you know, a lot of the people who don't have insurance have chronic conditions, so they're priced out of the market right away. A lot of companies won't even sell policies to them, so it's impossible to even say what's an average price, because if they won't issue a price, then the price is infinity.
I agree with that.
So I agree with everything you said right up until that point, and the idea that we're having problems and all of this is because we need to figure out the subsidies. Because you're exactly correct that the policy we would sell to every single individual on the exchange is exactly the same, with some exceptions with age rating, but could be done over the phone quite simply without subsidies. It would be much easier to do. That is absolutely correct.
Right now, so whether they delay the mandate or not, That wouldn't help people buy insurance. They're going to be able to buy insurance. The market, you can go get it right now.
But that's because of the law that they can buy it on the individual market now, right?
You can't get it right now because there's no way to get to the point in the websites where you can buy it until you go through the subsidy rigmarole. If they decided to change the website tomorrow and let people just buy insurance without going through that, it would work fine. But they have not yet made that change.
I beg to differ on that. I could right now do an application with two major insurance companies for a 1-1 effective date. I have the rate. I have the plan designs. It's just called an off-exchange application, and you would not qualify for a subsidy.
Yeah,
people
okay. So that's fine, but I think that most people, because they will qualify for subsidies, are not willing to go that route. I mean, again, if people were willing to avoid the subsidy, but 90% of people are expected to get a subsidy, they're not going to do that.
Peter, it's great to have an insurance salesman call in. Let's go to an IT guy, Rich in Virginia. You're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Hey, Pete. How you doing?
Good.
A couple comments. I tried to get on the website a day or two after they came up, and I got nowhere. Error messages, slow performance. And getting back to your comment about the difference between the new website and Medicare, there's no doubt it was a volume issue at that point in time, as far as what I was experiencing.
Oh, yeah.
Medicare is not going to have, at this point in time, millions of people hitting it on day one or day two, which this website did. So there was no doubt that it was a volume issue. I mean, that's just...
But at the beginning.
The issue on day one was a volume issue. But now that they have, or at least as they correct the volume issue, they're seeing there's 1,000 other problems.
Yeah.
In fact, the volume issue probably saved them from a nightmare scenario. If everybody had gotten online and everybody had filled out an application on day one and all of the applications had, you know, completely corrupted data sent to the insurance companies, we'd have a nightmare scenario because they would have to tell everyone in the United States to get back on the website and do it again, and people wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
So in some ways, the volume issue saved them, but that's just a terrible thing.
Now, my second comment is I waited a couple weeks and got back in, and I am able to proceed through many, many screens that I was not able to before. Okay, I'm able to fill out all kind of dependent information. I've taken it all the way up to the income information, and I stopped there because I didn't have the info in front of me. Now, I believe I agree with Dr. Carroll that now is where we're really going to see the issues, and that is the tremendous complexity that I would expect would be there, you know, once it has to take that information and pass it on and interpret it. But I'll be interested to see if people calling in have seen what I've seen, and that is that I'm able to get a responsive website and get through things that I couldn't get through 2 weeks ago.
Thanks a lot, Rich.
And I would agree, because I could not get on a day one either. And later I've gotten on and I've written pieces about sort of the plans that I've seen that I can purchase. I still see bugs. And that, like, I can't go back and change it from just me to my family. There are other things I click that go to the pages that don't exist, so there's still major issues, but it has gotten better. So I think they are getting a handle on the volume issue, but there are other serious issues which are not easily as fixed as the volume issue that happened. Again, look, this, we are now past the point of, you know, prognostication. You know, for years, you've been hearing people say it's the end of days and other people saying it's not going to be that bad. No longer. This is law. This is happening. You know, it won't be what I say here that makes the difference about whether this law works or not. I'm not trying to sway anyone's opinion as to loving the law or hating the law. It is. It's either going to work or it is not. And if they fix it tomorrow, great. If they fix it in 3 months, well, that's not as good. But it will just be proof is in the pudding. We're just going to see what happens.
Please don't say proof is in the pudding on the program.
I will never do that again.
Jesse in Virginia, you're on Stand Up, and most of the rest of the calls here seem to be about the law and less about the website and its issues, but that's fine. Go ahead, Jesse.
Yeah, I've moved past the stage of grief where I'm angry and I'm just depressed now about the website, so I won't ask about that. I've heard from people who I really do trust and find reliable that there's a problem in the law that the way I understand it, and hopefully, Dr. Carroll, you can explain this for me and help clarify it. But apparently, the way it is right now, if somebody doesn't pay their premiums, then goes to the doctor, and then the doctor charges them for whatever, the insurance company is on the hook for that cost. However, from what people are telling me, if people buy a policy over through the marketplace and they don't pay their premiums, the doctor is then on the hook for those costs. Can you clarify that? Are you familiar with that issue?
I think in both of those cases, if they don't pay their premium, they're on the hook. Now, the hospital system, back up. You have to remember that with the exception of emergency care, you don't have to give care. Doctors can say no, as can hospitals. And so if you show up and they say, show me your insurance card, and you don't have one or your insurance has been canceled, they can say, okay, how do you plan to pay for this? And if you can't pay cash, they can turn you away. That's what doctors can do. That's what they do today.
Yeah, but that's the case where if I didn't pay my premium last month, I still got my insurance card.
No. Believe me, they look it up. They type it into a computer and they check. They don't just take your word for it when you hand them a card. They get the card so they can plug it all into the computer and see what's going on.
Okay.
They're checking. Believe me, because they got to check your copay. They got to check your deductible. They got to check everything. They got to know how to bill you. So, you know, they're going to check that information to see what has happened, and you personally are on the hook if you're not insured. Now, granted, if there's, like, instances where, like, the check was a day late or this or that and you were planning to pay, well, that's a fight between you and your insurance company. But if you decided I'm just not going to have insurance anymore and the doctor doesn't check and the doctor just treats you, then the doctor is on the hook. But that's the way it's always been. That's the way it always will be. The law does not change any of that.
Thank you to, I think his name is Jesse. Joe in Texas, you're on with Aaron Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. Everybody should be following him. And the blog has a lot more information. The Incidental Economist, he writes and updates along with others every day. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I just really had a question as a new listener. I've got a friend of mine in Indiana who just received a letter, and she's on the state Medicaid there.
Mm-hmm.
That a friend of mine is on the state Medicaid there.
Uh-huh.
She was told that she wasn't going to have the insurance anymore due to Obamacare because she's above the poverty level, and she don't even have an income that amounts to $2,000 a month, and she has a child.
Well, I live in Indiana, and there's been no changes to the Medicaid plan moving forward. In fact, I believe that they just got a re-up of sort of their you know, exemption for the Healthy Indiana plan. Now, no more people are being allowed into Healthy Indiana because they don't have the money. And at this point, they are refusing to do the Medicaid expansion as they continue to negotiate with HHS, but there has been no contraction of Medicaid. And in fact, because they're refusing the expansion, Obamacare does not eliminate anybody off of Medicaid that was on Medicaid before. It changes nothing about the previous way the Medicaid program is expanded. In fact, that's what the Supreme Court case was about. It was allowing states to just keep Medicaid the way it was without changing a thing. And they won. That is the law. That's what the Supreme Court said, that they can keep Medicaid. So if they say that they're blaming it on the law, they're playing loose and fast with the facts, because that is not the way that the law handles. Medicaid is going to continue in Indiana as it did before exactly, unless they decide to go ahead with the expansion.
There you go, Joe. Let's go to David in California for Dr. Aaron Carroll.
Good morning, guys. My question is I work for a major trucking company that's non-union.
Yep.
In fact, it's FedEx Freight. It's one of the largest trucking companies in North America. And our insurance has pretty much doubled, if not tripled. And my fellow employees are under the impression this is all because of Obamacare. Now, I've been listening to you guys for 4 years, and I admit I'm still a little confused. I do follow the blog. I follow all this, but I'm on the road right now. My question is the Obamacare law care forcing my company to raise its rates for our medical? And we went from like a $500 deductible to $1,200, and out-of-pocket maximum went from like $3,000 to $9,600. We went from like, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, let me start with that. So nothing in the law says that they have to raise your deductible. Now, what the law does say is that if they were providing you with sort of crap insurance, that it has to come up to scale to be of a certain level. So two things. One is that...
Because they have so many employees at FedEx.
Right. So deductibles have been going up across the board. I mean, the average deductible in the United States average is approaching $1,000. You guys are a little higher than average, but that is not. That has all been happening outside of Obamacare. Before Obamacare went into effect, all those things happened. Out-of-pocket maximums have also been going up. However, the law says that the maximum out-of-pocket maximum for an individual is like $6,250, I think. So that can't be, or something is wrong, because the maximum out-of-pocket that a plan is allowed to be qualified as okay does have a cap, and that is above it.
And that's so part of the law, the cap.
That is part of the law that set a cap on how high the out-of-pocket maximum could be. It's the same as what, you know, you're allowed to sort of have in an high-deductible health care plan. I could be off by a couple bucks because I don't remember the exact number, but it's somewhere in the low 6,000s. But the more important part is, like, regardless of whether they raised your rates or not, they cannot charge you premiums more than 9.5% of your income. If your premium cost is more than 9.5% of your income, then that is not a qualified plan. You're allowed to go to the exchange. You're allowed to get the subsidy, and they will be penalized for doing so. Now, they may not want you to know that because they may be, you know, hoping that you just sort of suck it up and pay the bills, but they're not allowed to raise your rates to you to the point where they are more than 9.5% of your income.
Now, there you go, Dave.
Yeah, my mistake. I said 96. I meant 32 because I'm looking at the paperwork here.
But okay, well then that is okay. Well then that would be okay. Now that granted, again, I would say that is possible. But you know, some people I think have been living in. I have a really good plan that I pay for through Indiana University, and I pay a lot. You know, they pay like $8,000. I pay probably like $10,000 on top of that. I mean, we have pretty expensive insurance, and every single member of my family has their own $400 deductible. There are five of us. Our family deductible is $1,200. Our out-of-pocket maximum is in the thousand. I mean, I pay for ridiculously expensive insurance, and that's what insurance costs. You know, that it is not as if Obamacare raised the price of insurance. Insurance is ridiculously expensive in the United States. The average family health insurance plan in the United States is $16,000 for employer-provided insurance. For an individual, it's like well over six. That's a lot of money, and that does not include deductibles. That does not include co-pays. That does not include out-of-pocket. And that's average. You know, I think people are sort of waking up to the fact that insurance is expensive, and now we have something to blame it on. But this was bad before. And this is going to continue until we find ways to sort of put this all into perspective and try to, you know, come up with better ways perhaps to have an insurance system. But this was not about radically reducing the price of insurance. This was trying to get everybody insured in the system that we have where everything is already very expensive.
Dr. Aaron Carroll joining us. Thank you. Is it Joe? What's his name? Jay in Baltimore. You're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. The Incidental Economist is the blog. Go ahead, Jay.
No, good morning, gentlemen. I actually do work for Social Security and helped build their retirement application, Medicare application, their subsidy application, so on and so forth. And so I have very good front-hand information and knowledge on building applications like that and applications that interact with the states because of our disability determination services, applications that cross between public and private with the health information technology and working with FHA and so on and so forth. And so my mind is, blown that they just didn't come right down the street and ask us to help them build their website. They actually went out to a contractor when they had, in-house expertise, and that just confuses me. And I didn't know if there was any, reason.
I think that's the law. I mean, I don't think you can. Don't you have to put it out for bids?
I don't know. I mean, this is where I sympathize, because it's like, this is where I
think Jay.
Those of us who, who believe the government can do things, I also have to sort of realize the government is still just people. Not everybody knows what they're doing. Like, a lot of this stuff seems like common sense to people who are inside the system, but if you have, bureaucrats running it and they don't know the intricacies and they're not properly resourced or sort of tasked with the right, projects, then it is possible they just did not know what they didn't know. And it sounds like that there was not a lot of communication up and down the chain for people who do this. I've read a number of good pieces by Inside the Tech, inside sort of tech industry, by people who have talked about like how it appears they designed the software, and they were not using best practices at all for software design. I mean, anyone who sort of knows anything about how this is done would just shake their head and be like, "You got to be kidding me."
It does begin a conversation about government contracting and bidding and the fact that government generally, can't pay for the best necessarily in the business to do something. It creates a conversation about procurement. But I mean,
it is. But I mean, when the Pentagon wants to buy a tank, they don't build the tank. What they do is they say, "Hey, we need a tank. We need exactly X, Y, Z. Build it
right
for us." And then they know what they need. They're experts. They really have it. No one had done this in to build this before. So it is not as if they could say, "Oh my God, we need a website. We need it to know that it can do this and this, that it can do this and this, and it has to be able to communicate." And the specs are not determined. And it's not as if they've had years to develop over time, what the sub needs. It's that they needed something sort of brand new and out of the box, and it is very possible that they did not know how to order it correctly, or that they didn't realize the complexities, or they didn't know what they didn't know. And that is a real issue. It is not as if they went to, one big expensive company that's really good at this and said, "Build us something from start to finish." That's not the way they did it, and that's not the way they probably can do it, but that's a real problem.
Well, we got to wrap it up here, unfortunately, today. I wanted to obviously take it for the whole hour. I made a scheduling problem, but we will we'll continue certainly next week, obviously, with our guest, Dr. Carroll. I hope you're following him on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Aaron, thanks so much for your time today. Phones are locked with people that are curious and have questions, and thanks so much for providing them with the best answers you can.